Good morning. Good morning. Good morning to the hardiest members of the class. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. First of all, may I thank you, each and every one, who have come and joined me for this extraordinary series on women in academia and the importance of women in everyday life. We personally understand. We understand so many of our contributions. It was a thrill for certainly me, and I think all of us, to understand the academic heights that women have not only reached, but the authority that they've been given with their deanships, their high professorships, their admissions into the Academy of Medicine, Academy of Science, Academy of Astronomy, extraordinary pieces. But we couldn't have done it alone. You know, I said, I have the big gift. One, I have wonderful women joining me, and I'm so grateful to each and every one of you. And I can't tell you that enough. Second of all, I must thank the people who really help us create it. Now, you met Marilyn McCoy at the dinner. Marilyn really helps me. Once the subject is chosen in my head, then I go to Marilyn and Morty Shapiro, our president, and they start allocating people that they think are correct. Once that occurs, then we need someone to help us transcribe and record the lectures so that we can then read them online in other parts of the world, because this class travels a lot. And we have created a gift that is something that probably trying to find a neutral gift is complicated. So it seemed to us that an Amazon certificate is comfortable for everyone. We want to thank, first of all, the leader, our Amy, who is, we all know Amy. We love her and we thank Amy. And assisting her is our beautiful new addition. The additional assistant is Mia. Mia. And we want to thank Stephen, who is, I think, somewhere here, Joe Glover, and Milo, and to thank you very, very much. We appreciate it, and you will see me before I leave this building. Thank you. And thank you also, mostly also to our coordinator, because she's been here, and she synthesizes great thoughts into a very clear synopsis of every lecture. And we're very grateful to the brilliant, and as my husband said, really impressive, Rachel Mercy.
Thank you. Thank you. My synopsis might get longer today because I get to talk. So I also get to synthesize myself. I'm actually going to introduce here by unmuting what's on the screen. So this Christine is going to pop up. There she is. We're joined today by Christine Brennan, columnist for USA Today, esteemed sports writer, and I think this is the first time I've ever introduced a Northwestern Board of Trustee member, so that's also an honor. I'll tell you what Christine can see of us. So if you can see that camera right there where you can see me kind of pointing at the screen, that's that camera in the back of the room. I'm actually going to switch this to camera 2. Let's see if that goes. So now she's able to see the room. Not terribly well, although her picture is larger. But if you give her a wave, that's what she's able to see. There you go. But she's go not fast. Able to. Go you fast. Need to really be at this. That is someone prepared for television. You need to be here at this microphone to speak. So I'm going to leave it to Christine. Christine, when you're ready to open it up for questions, I'll move up here to the microphone and we'll go from there. So, please, join me in welcoming Christine Brennan.
Thank you all very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
You can. Great. I think if I talk, I can't hear you, and if there's some kind of noise, you probably can't hear me. Anyway, I will do my best. It is an honor to be with you. I am sorry that it is electronic and not in person. I'm actually going to be in for meetings on Friday, but I just could not break away from Washington, D.C., which is where I am. In fact, I'm only about 4 miles where there's another event going on in Washington you may have heard of. it's 4 miles that way. So I'm in Northwest D.C., not far from Chevy Chase Circle in Chevy Chase, Maryland, if you know the area. And, of course, the Capitol is that away. But I couldn't get away today to be there in person, and I'm so sorry about that. Shirley, I want to say a huge thank you to you for this terrific series. And, of course, you're a dear friend, and what you and your family do for our beloved Northwestern. Well, it would take all my 30 minutes and more, and I won't do that, but I think you know how much we love you and respect you, and the continuing gift of Shirley Ryan, the Ryan family, it's extraordinary. It's breathtaking. So thank you, thank you, thank you from all of us for all that you do. I also, just thanks to all my friends there, my good pal Missy Isaacson, I know is right there, and she's going to be presenting after I do. So I look at myself as kind of the warm-up act for Melissa Isaacson. And that is a good role, an honorable role for me to play. So Missy has a great new book out. She's going to be, I'm sure, talking about that. We've grown up together in the business, Missy and I. We've been at Olympics together. We've driven around Australia after the Sydney Olympics together and many other adventures. So I'm honored to be on the panel today or on the schedule today with Melissa Isaacson. She's great, and I was honored to blurb her book. You probably didn't know that was a verb and a noun, but to blurb her book, her wonderful book, which I hope you buy and get a chance to read. It's fantastic. So what I thought I would do is talk for a few minutes, throw out a few ideas and thoughts, and then take as many questions as we have time for. Love questions. All this is on the record. You're talking to a journalist. This is your chance to turn the tables and ask questions of me. You know, part of the mainstream media, or the what did Sarah Palin call us, the lamestream media. There's a lot of names for us right now, but I am very proud to be a journalist. I'm very proud to be a graduate of Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. I was class of 1980 undergrad. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have VCRs. We didn't have DVRs. We didn't have answering machines. And I think Abraham Lincoln was president when I was in school. And then I got my undergrad in 80, my master's in 81, also from Medill. And Medill launched me into the career and the world and the life of my dreams. I never would have envisioned when I left Northwestern in March of 81 with my master's. I was a quarter ahead, so I came out a quarter early, undergrad and master's. I never would have envisioned, ladies and gentlemen, or I guess maybe it's just ladies, that I would have been telling you, sitting here all these years later, close to 40 years later, that I would go to every single Olympics after I graduated and never miss one. And it would be not with my family or friends, which is what I would have envisioned, that I would I love the Olympics. I'm sure many of you do, that I would, you know, be having to pay and go, which I would have thought would have been the way I would have done that. But that I would go to all these Olympics, all expenses paid, working for the Miami Herald, where I started my career, the Washington Post, where I proudly worked for 12 years, and now USA Today as a columnist, as well as CNN, ABC News, PBS NewsHour, and NPR, among a few others, and that I would be working for them, that I would be reporting on television and, of course, in print and online, and it would be 18 Olympics in a row, looking forward to my 19th Olympics next summer, the 2020 Games in Tokyo in Japan. If someone had traveled in time and showed up at my sorority house at Chi Omega, as I was graduating undergrad or my master's, and said, this is your future, 18 Olympics in a row, you'll never miss one again, I think I might have burst into tears at the thought of what what that might look like. And here I am sitting before you as a proud product of Medill, and we've gone through a couple tough days, but we're much better for it. And I've been helping and talking to some of our Medill and Daily students. I'm sure you're familiar with what's happened. If not, I'll let you Google that. But talking to some of our Daily reporters, and they're going to be okay. What Northwestern gave me, I will never in a million years be able to repay. The life of my dreams, the adventure of a lifetime. And as I said, that's just one little slice of it with the Olympic Games and Super Bowls and World Series. Just covered the three games of the World Series here in Washington, D.C., and on it goes. And how did this happen? Because back in the day when Melissa and I were dreaming of becoming journalists, I don't know about you, Melissa, but I kind of had this secret dream that I could be a sports writer, but I didn't even know if it could happen. Because when I'm growing up in the suburbs of Toledo, Ohio, in the 60s and 70s, the only woman I saw on TV doing sports was Phyllis George, who had been Miss America in 1971. Now, I love Phyllis George. I know her well, and her daughter, Pam Brown, on CNN, you see her all the time, is lovely and is a good friend, is a friend as well and a colleague. But if you had to be Miss America to be on television and doing sports coverage, that was not going to be my career path. Although we did joke that if I was ever in the Miss America pageant, which I would never, ever have been able to be in the Miss America pageant, but if I had been in the Miss America pageant, that my father, my talent would have been my dad coming on stage with me and throwing me baseballs, and I'd be hitting them into the audience. That would have been the talent. Would have been a little unconventional. Anyway, if it was Phyllis George, and I never read, get this, everyone, I never read a woman's sports byline in the newspaper. Toledo Blade, Detroit Free Press, Detroit News, Chicago Papers, never. Then I show up at Northwestern. I go into the Daily Northwestern. I ask where the sports department is. And sure enough, they point me over to a place where a woman is standing. And it's Helene Elliott, also one of our fantastic graduates, class of 77. Helene is the sports editor. And I couldn't believe my eyes. And right then and there, I saw the path for me. It was the first time I'd ever seen a woman writing sports. She had some bylines and columns, so I got a chance to read her in the Daily. And that showed me the way. And even though my mom and dad, wonderful parents that they were, my dad was the biggest Republican I knew and also the biggest feminist I knew. And that shows we were taking stereotypes and busting them in half in the Brennan household. I stress that he was an Illinois Republican, a South Side of Chicago Republican. But he just encouraged me. My mom encouraged me. I'm the oldest of four kids. I am 6 feet tall. I played six sports in high school. I couldn't get enough of playing baseball with the boys when I was growing up. I never threw like a girl. And by the way, can we all agree we take that term throw like a girl and throw it out? Because when we say throw like a girl, or if someone says it in a derisive way, in a derisive manner, what they're doing, of course, is giving a great compliment. Because, of course, we're teaching all of your daughters and granddaughters to throw the ball the right way. So, frankly, throw like a girl now is a compliment. But back in the day when girls didn't throw the ball properly, my dad taught me how to fire the ball from behind my right ear and played baseball with me. Other dads were playing with their sons, and my dad was playing baseball and playing sports with me. And he was the Pied Piper with season tickets. We had season tickets to Toledo Rockets football, Michigan football. Grew up as a Michigan fan. That's changed now, but I was a big Michigan fan growing up. Ann Arbor's just 45 minutes from Toledo. We were White Sox fans because my grandparents lived on the South Side. And we couldn't go to enough sporting events. I couldn't get enough of sports. I played sports. And as I said, I didn't even know if I could be a sports journalist. I thought I might be a political reporter until I walked into the Daily in September of 76. What did I learn from that moment? I learned that children need to see someone who looks like them to encourage them to be able to say they can do something. And I learned that and was kind of got in my brain at that moment, even though that would have been a young age to think this, that I was going to be the role model, try to be the role model that I never had. And so one of the things I feel very proud of is the Association for Women in Sports Media. And if you have any young women or young men in your life who would like to maybe be in sports journalism, have them check that out. Association for Women in Sports Media, AWSM, we call it AWSM. Missy's a member, a longtime member. I was the first president. And from 88 to 90, I started our scholarship internship program that has now awarded more than about 200 scholarships and internships to young women. We do allow men to join. We are never going to be exclusive. Having been excluded for years ourselves, we certainly are supportive of men as well as women. But it's mostly young women that are coming to us. And as soon as I'm finished here, I'm going to be talking to a young woman from Cornell who wants to talk about possibly getting into sports media. And I would say, and I know, Missy, you get this too, I'd say two, three, four women a week I hear from either at my website, which is just my name, christinebrennan.com, if anyone wants to go there, or other ways, other Twitter, what have you, they reach out. There are so many women now, young women, these young kids in their teens and early 20s who want to be in sports media. It's an explosion. We have well over 1,000 women covering sports in the country now. By the way, I won't delve on the locker room issue, but sometimes people are asked, do women go into men's locker rooms? And the answer, of course, is yes. That is the workplace. That is where we do our interviews. And it has been equal for men and women since 1985. So if you run into somebody at a cocktail party, some guy who says, I don't know about this, you can tell them it's been settled since 1985. And the other big point is men absolutely go into women's locker rooms. Unfortunately, women's sports are not as compelling as our sports world doesn't care as much about women's sports as men yet. Maybe who knows when. But yes, on the Final Four, women's basketball Final Four, other things, absolutely. Male reporters are in female locker rooms, and I would be the first person to stand outside with a man if he were denied entry to do his job, the way so many men stood with me when I was denied entry, which I was when I first started at the Miami Herald from 81, 82, 83, when things were still a patchwork of could a woman be allowed in that locker room, yes or no. For example, the Miami Dolphins, Don Shula, the legendary coach, gave his players robes and said, okay, every reporter's in. So I was in that Dolphins locker room doing my job. It's not a sexy or exciting. It's just you're doing your job. In fact, when I called back to Toledo to ask my dad for advice going into the Dolphins locker room, he just said, honey, keep eye contact at all times. And that was great advice from Dad back in the early 80s, and still the advice I use today. What do I see in the locker room? The whites of their eyes. That's my story. I'm sticking with it. Also carry an 8x11 notebook, so in case you have to look down, you just see the notebook. But the good news is back in the 80s, when there would be some problems, and Missy, you dealt with this too, a player didn't want to wear a towel, or players didn't want to wear Don Shula's, the robes that he gave to the Miami Dolphins. And by the way, Don Shula was a conservative man, and yet he figured it out and said, hey, women are a part of our media. There are going to be more and more of them. We've got to figure this out and have women in the locker room just like men. And these women, by the way, were coming from major, major newspapers. I was lucky enough to be at the Miami Herald to start as its first woman sports writer at the Herald in 81. Then in Northwestern, Medill had a pipeline to the Herald, so a lot of my friends were there from college. Then the Washington Post, my dream job. Was the Washington football team going to deny the Post entry to a locker room? No. So we give great credit to these sports editors, most of them men, but some women, who gave women these jobs, not even sure that they could do the job, and yet then pushed hard and stood behind them. When I was dealing with the Washington NFL football team, I try not to say that sadly racist nickname, the R word, the Skins, that I've said millions of times, but I'm trying not to anymore. When I was covering that team and they at first didn't want to have women in the locker room, it wasn't just me standing there. It was Catherine Graham. It was Ben Bradley. It was George Solomon. And sure enough, the team relented. Joe Gibbs, a wonderful man who just didn't believe it was right to have a woman in the locker room, but he said, we'll follow the rules. You're in the locker room. End of conversation. How lucky was I to have that kind of support? I've never lost sight of that. And when I went in the locker room, and I don't want to dwell too much on the locker room issue, but when I went into the locker room, I was treated right. I was treated right. There would be teasing a little bit. This was 3 years, by the way, of covering this team, so they got to know me as well as they got to know their teammates. And I was there every day for the Washington Post as the beat writer covering the Skins. 85, 86, and 87. You might remember those days. Those were days when Washington actually won games and won Super Bowl. I know you Bears fans are having a little bit of that now, too. But in Washington, it's a lot worse now. But back then, this was a winning team. I covered a winning Super Bowl at the 88 Super Bowl in San Diego, Washington over Denver. But I also knew, and I think Missy would tell you the same thing, that I also had, I was on their turf. And this was the 80s. This wasn't now. We didn't have Me Too. You're not going to go yelling or screaming or complaining. You had to deal with some stuff that you'd never want your daughters in the workplace to deal with now, or your granddaughters. But back then, you did. Who was I going to tell? I wasn't going to derail my career. So I laughed at some jokes that now we wouldn't laugh at. And I put up with some of the nonsense from some of these guys. Again, harmless in many ways, but also could be a little bit abusive, or certainly it would be inhospitable. And yet, I was in my dream job, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. It wasn't even a job. I feel like I've never worked a day in my life, because I get to do what I love, traveling the world, covering sports and talking about sports and sports issues now, which I really love, sports and culture. And that intersection of sports and culture now is a 12-lane superhighway. So those issues, be they Colin Kaepernick and Donald Trump, or the women's soccer team, equal pay, Antonio Brown, Ray Rice, the terrible USA Gymnastics story. I've been breaking a lot of the U.S. figure skating news involving Me Too and sexual abuse of young girls and young men in figure skating. I've been breaking a lot of that this year. These terrible stories, these difficult stories, Penn State a few years ago. And that's where I am now. But I get to do this as a journalist I'm just living my dreams. And I am so fortunate. And so that's one of the reasons I spend a lot of time talking to students, to encourage them, and especially young women, to show them that they can do this, and that there's a wonderful world out there for them as well. And as I said, there are over 1,000 women covering sports in our country now. And this tidal wave of Title IX, when I was talking to Marilyn McCoy, Marilyn, are you there? I don't know if you are. I know I'll see her in a few days. But Marilyn was so instrumental in having this happen, as well as Shirley today, that I could join you. Marilyn is just one of the great leaders at Northwestern. And as we were talking about this, she said, talk about Title IX. And so I'll do that for just checking our time here. I'll do that for a couple minutes, and then I will open it up for questions, if that's okay. But Title IX, I believe, is the most important law in our country over the last 50 years. Now, I realize there's a lot of competition for that title, and I'm sure many of you can think of other laws that have happened and have been signed since 1972. But I'll make my case here. President Richard Nixon signed Title IX in June of 1972. He basically did it to make it so that there would be equivalent opportunities for women as well as men in law schools and medical schools. That was the idea. Because there's federal funds going to these things, how can you discriminate if you're using federal funds, which would mean all taxpayers' money, men and women paying their taxes? That was what the idea was. Well, relatively soon, it was interpreted as also about the equivalent opportunities in sports, in our high schools and in our colleges. And that, of course, is what all of us know today, is the application and the way that Title IX has been enforced and has been looked at and has been used to create an unbelievable revolution in our nation. Think about this. 30 or 40 years ago, you were driving driving in your neighborhoods, and you had looked over and seen a girl on a sports field with a whole bunch of boys, let's say, right? You would have done a double take in 1970, 1975, 1980, and certainly before that. Like, what's that girl doing over there? What's she doing with those boys on a sports field playing baseball or, well, soccer? We probably just were starting it then, or football or lacrosse or, you know, you name it. What's she doing? Well, the odds are she was probably there having run over to tell her brother it was time to come home for dinner. That's probably what was happening. Now, think about it. I know it's a snowy, icy, cold day, so you're probably not going to see too many kids out on a field today. But a month or two ago, when you were driving through your neighborhood and you went by a field, high school, middle school, elementary school, whatever, and you saw a group of women playing sports, or a group of girls playing field hockey or soccer, whatever, would you have given it a second thought? Would you have done a double take? Of course not. That is the change ladies and gentlemen, in our country, in what is really the blink of an eye in our nation's history. It's remarkable. And I don't think that any of us have come to grips with what Title IX really means. And by that, I mean this. That for generations, we were allowing only half of our nation to learn about winning at a young age, and even more important, to learn about losing at a young age. We were only allowing half of our nation to learn about teamwork and sportsmanship and have good physical fitness habits. We were only allowing half of our nation to do all that, to learn those valuable life lessons that make not only a better athlete, but even more important, a better person. And so, because of Richard Nixon, and maybe inadvertently, all of a sudden, we are now allowing the other half of our nation, actually 51% of our nation, to learn how to win and to learn how to lose at a young age, to learn about teamwork and sportsmanship, to be physically fit. And what does that mean? Well, we're starting to see it now. I don't think it's any surprise at all that we have more than 100 women now in Congress in the United States, in the House of Representatives. And we have 25 women in the Senate. Well, that's not 50-50 yet, but I guarantee it's going to be 50-50 in the next 20 or 30 years. Guaranteed. And here's how I know. I believe that all of those women are there, plus all the women that are going to run for president in the 30s and 40s. We'll have woman president after woman president. Guaranteed. They'll be picking women as their vice president. Guarantee this. Not necessarily right now, obviously, but moving forward, maybe 20s, not so sure, but 30s, 40s, 50s, and onward. And the common denominator for all of those women, plus all the women leading businesses, universities, presidents of universities, et cetera, common denominator for all of them will be that they played sports because of Title IX, and they learned those life lessons. And today, and I've met some of our these congresswomen and senators. Kirsten Gillibrand's a great athlete. So many of these congresswomen are terrific athletes. They're younger now. They're in their 30s and 40s. They played sports. They may not have been Olympic athletes. Probably not. They may not have been even good college athletes, but they played and they learned those life lessons, and then they've gone on to be great leaders in our country. What men used, the vehicle and the doorways that men, the pathways that men used for generations, the Bill Bradleys of the world, to become great leaders, now we're allowing the other half of our population to learn that, to use that. And as I said, we haven't even begun to see this incredible tidal wave of Title IX and how it's going to impact our country. And why I feel so comfortable and confident saying this is because of the numbers, the demographics. They're coming. You know them. You'll see them at Thanksgiving, right? These are the wonderful 20-somethings and 30-somethings who are playing sports. They will play sports their whole lives. They'll have great disposable incomes to do that. They may well be moms, or they may not be moms. They may get married, they may not get married. But they are going to be leaders, and I do believe those learning those life lessons through sports will be the reason why. So, yeah, I kind of think Title IX is just a little bit of a big deal, as you can tell. And I will end with this. Our wonderful and beloved Northwestern has led the way in Title IX, way ahead of all the other Big Ten schools. When Michigan and Ohio State, when Woody and Bo were grumbling and complaining they didn't want women, you know, playing sports, they did actually do this. Bo Schembechler said women didn't deserve the same size letter M, Michigan M, as his football players did. He apologized soon after that. Northwestern, we were encouraging it. Our women's basketball team in the 70s was great, beating all the Big Ten schools back then, before there was even an NCAA. And I think the success we have seen, I've had this prop here, Northwestern lacrosse, seven NCAA titles for Northwestern in one sport, Kelly Amate-Hiller and her great team. We should all support that. That is the very definition of one generation standing on the shoulders of the next, and especially with Title IX and women's sports at Northwestern. We have been leading the way, and Kelly, with all of these young players who become coaches, all these women now coaching around the country, the Northwestern Kelly Amate coaching tree, all of these players, Northwestern grads, who are now coaching at other universities and leading more young women to success, not only on the athletic field, but in life. And so, obviously, I'm waving the banner, the purple and white here, but Northwestern really is a tremendous leader in Title IX, and we should be very proud of that. So on that note, if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them. Thank you.
Christine, we've actually run out of time, so I will take one question from the audience, but I'm afraid we'll have to cut it short. I'm sorry. Yes.
Of course.
So the question is about what is the budget difference between the men's football team and the women's lacrosse team?
Well, it's enormous. I don't know the exact numbers, but and whether it's Northwestern or any school, and you know, it's all. Frankly, I'm sure we're doing better than most, but it's enormous. That's a conversation, of course, that could take up several more hours. And I know, Rachel, I can see you going, no. But suffice it to say, I'm a glass half full person. And women's sports have made such strides. The high school levels where you really should see equality, equal payment, equal everything, buses, practice time. And that's what we've seen incredible change there, where the girls get a chance to play at this, you know, practice at the same time they switch off with the boys, or games are at the same time. And if your high school kids don't get a chance to showcase, the girls don't get a chance to have the prime times in basketball on a Friday night or something, then that's a Title IX violation. And that high school should change to make sure they alternate boys and girls with the key primetime games or the prime practice times. But colleges, I mean, football is king. I love football. I mean, of course. So I don't think there's any problem with that. I'll end though with this note, a very subtle thing, but to answer your question, most of the Big Ten schools and most of the big five conference football programs believe in their own little world, right? And they do everything on their own and they don't share. I mean, I think if any of us walked into the Nebraska weight room, we might get arrested. and I'm not picking on Nebraska, Ohio State, Michigan. Like, no, that's football. That's football. Well, Northwestern, we don't do things that way. And our beautiful, have any of you been able to be in our beautiful new facility, the terrific practice facility that is on the lake, obviously north of campus? Looks like a spaceship landed, right? And of course, the Ryans are part of all of our amazing giving and facilities. Again, thanks, Shirley, for all of that. Well, if you walk in and look at that field, it's a football field, right? And that's where Pat Fitzgerald and the team practice. But you'll see something else on that field, and it's permanent, and they're lacrosse lines. Think about that. Northwestern's football facility has permanent lacrosse lines. We only have one lacrosse team. We don't have a men's team. For the women's lacrosse team to be able to practice and play. I would be shocked to hear of another football coach in the country that would okay that, except Pat Fitzgerald. And another, of course, the leadership of our university athletic department, et cetera, Jim Phillips and others. But think about that. Those lines are on that field forever, and they were built there that way for lacrosse, so that our women's lacrosse team can practice in that facility. That is remarkable, and that is very different, and I think another reason to be so proud of Northwestern. The glass is half full. Women's sports is so fantastic, and women in sports media and women in our culture, they're all linked, frankly. It's all part of the same conversation, and I am very proud to be able to chronicle that, be a part of that, and be a lucky beneficiary of that. So, again, thanks so much. Sorry for running a little late, but it's great to be with you, and thanks again for this wonderful honor.
Thank you, Christine. Please join me in thanking Christine Brennan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to do a little presto change-o here when it comes to what you see on the screen, but the good news is I think we're going to see some consistency in topic as we move on to Melissa Isaacson. Melissa and I actually have offices next door to each other, but I think we've seen each other more in Learning for Life at the dinner last week and today than we've probably seen each other in the buildings, which is a testament to how busy both of us are. But it also gives credit to Melissa, benefited from Title IX, played on a state-winning basketball team. That's what her second book was about? Third book. Third book was about, although he is going to need your password. You don't have to say it into the mic. And so it'll be a nice transition from what Christine introduced us to into kind of what's happening at Medill and what's happening with Melissa's career. So please join me in welcoming Melissa Isaacson. Thank you.
No? Oh. Maybe just talk louder. That is, you know what, I have to like, use my hand, okay. So I thought this would be better. Is this any better?
That will work.
Not really?
Yes.
Maybe just talk louder? How about that? Project? Okay. Thank you so much for having me as well, to Mrs. Ryan and to Rachel, of course, and to Amy. Chris is a hard act to follow. She was idol to many, and I won't make her feel old and say she's not here, so I could say that. She was my idol, too. But not just a generous friend, but somebody who, when you find women who give to other women and who support other women, it's really special. Not that it's super rare, but it's really, really appreciated, and certainly she was one of those, and you know, the work she's doing is so important. I'll differ from her one thing. She's 6 feet tall, so she could look in the eyes of athletes in locker rooms. I always use a legal pad. It's longer than this one, but yeah, so this, that was a bad choice of words, but that's what I use. I think of me as sort of a prequel to Christine. I'm going to talk a little bit about Title IX, but I'm also, and thanks for your patience in allowing me, even though you have no choice, to have me talk about my book. I think it'll sort of set the groundwork and make both Christine and what I'm going to say maybe fit together a little bit better. So if you'll allow me, I'm going to just show you a short video, 3-minute video.
Go ahead and hit play.
Okay.
All the marbles will be going in this particular game. We are the best, says Niles West. Niles West becomes the new state champion. Number one, they have the banners ready, believe me. State champion.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend, 'cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor, no one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa, yes, I'm
book State. Author Melissa Isaacson takes us on a journey back to the 70s.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the first and only women's basketball state championship for Niles West High School.
Title IX created an opening for a group of young women hungry to play organized sports.
She has a new book out called State.
Melissa, you won a state championship back in 1979.
Now an author of a new book called State.
This is really about the infancy of competitive women's basketball.
They were one of the first girls' teams in the state after Title IX passed in 1972.
was a lot of me, but my nephew did that. It was very sweet of him. And I used this for a Northwestern panel in October to introduce a panel discussion that I had with me, another teammate of mine, and Amy Eshelman, who I discovered fairly recently. How many of you know Amy Eshelman? She's the wife of Lori Lightfoot. And she, coincidentally, when I met her, I didn't realize this, was a member of the very first Illinois State girls basketball champion, Sterling High School, in 1977. So when I met the mayor several months ago, she said, "How do you not know my wife?" And she like pushed me over toward Amy, and Amy and I embraced. Ooh, sorry. We're state champs, you know. So it was very exciting. And she spoke on this panel as well. And you can find it on my website if you're interested. It was really pretty cool. It was one of the highlights of my life, I would say. But seeing this video and seeing the pictures of me shooting into, that was me in the wicker basket, and me and my teammate Connie playing with our brothers, playing football, it always makes me smile. But it also makes me remember about my experience with sports as a child. I was the youngest of four. My sister Susie is 12 years older than me, and my brother Barry is 10 years older, and Richard is 8 years older. And though my sister tried her best, and believe me, she really, really tried her best, my brothers ended up having the most influence on me, and that meant playing sports with them. And I put playing in quote marks because I was clearly not up to, being much younger, I wasn't up to really competing with them. But what it meant was running after them, and Christine made me smile because that's the truth. You know, little girls in those days, and all of you, I'm sure, can relate. If you were out playing with boys, it was that you were chasing after the boys in the neighborhood, your brothers are telling them to come home, and obviously not playing competitively. So it was often me with my brothers playing baseball in the park and me being situated in the bank parking lot beyond the field, beyond the park. Just little me, baseball glove in my hand, waiting for my big chance, not being able to even see the batter, incidentally, but ready, just the same. And my brothers, when they tell the story of this particular day, are pretty consistent in their recollections. They describe the ball that came off my brother Richard's bat further than he had ever hit it in his 15-year-old life, coming straight at me like they described a Scud missile. Uncanny, they both say now. What I remember is what they yelled then, which was, "Run, Missy, run." So I ran, and the ball, guided as if by radar, met the top of my head, and down I went. And my next memory is opening my eyes and seeing five teenage boys' faces about 3 inches from my face, scared to death that I was concussed, and that her mother would find out, not necessarily in that order, incidentally. And we all came to this unspoken and sort of unanimous decision at that point that we wouldn't tell. Yeah, we would not tell. That none of us would tell, that it would be our secret. It was not the first time that secrets were made and similar packs occurred. I was often the goalie in hockey and the punt returner in football. And secrecy was always sort of emerged as a theme. It was a secret when tired of watching my neighbor Anthony put on a real uniform and pedaling off to his Little League games that I would sneak into the closet where my mom had a dresser and pull out my brother's Little League caps that were so cool with the L on them, and they were just cool. If any other one of you thought baseball caps were cool when you were little, but I thought they were cool, any uniform. And I would sneak putting them on. I'm not sure why it was a secret, but it just wasn't necessarily accepted. Wasn't necessarily so cool for a little girl to be walking around in their brother's clothes. It was a secret as well when our first high school basketball coach at Niles West, which you saw in that montage, Arlene Mulder, sought the help of the boys' varsity coach at the school at the time, Billy Schnur, who was a legendary coach. And they'd huddle in the corner of the teacher's lounge, him teaching her the game so that she could teach us. An equally secret was when, along the way, Mrs. Mulder taught Mr. Schnur how to motivate and how to inspire.
in a way that boys' coaches just weren't doing at the time, you know. Boys' coaches knew their boys' players by their last name. That was pretty much it, you know, while they ordered them to do push-ups. They weren't doing a whole lot of inspiring, necessarily. I never knew when I began, until I began reporting for a column I would write for the Tribune in 2004, that our Niles West principal, Nicholas Manis, was not, as we thought, the lucky benefactor of a team that won a state championship in girls basketball in 1979, but that as a member of the Illinois High School Association executive board, he was running downstate every other weekend to fight with the men who believed basketball was simply too dangerous for girls. That not only that, but furthermore, there was no way in hell girls were taking valuable gym time on Friday nights from the boys. I mean, it's incredible. When I tell my students now, you know, they look at me like I'm from another planet, and I'm like, I'm not that old, and this was happening. We didn't know that after Dr. Manis won that fight, and several years later handed us this giant state championship trophy on that night in 79, that we were the ones who were lucky to have him and not the other way around. When I entered high school in 1975, girls varsity basketball was 1 year old. When Christine talked about Ohio, for whatever reason, Illinois is way behind the other states in terms of girls' sports. For 50 years, girls didn't have competitive high school sports. So in the 70s, when I entered high school, we were not allowed to practice or play in the boys' gym. That's what it was called. And I'm sure all of you are like, of course it was the boys' gym. The contest gym, right? The big gym. By my sophomore year, we were allowed in, but the boys' coaches weren't so thrilled, right, to share. So the only way we would get extra time in the big gym was to wake up at 4 in the morning, to go to school at 4:30, and to scrimmage before the men teachers would come in and play their pickup games. And secretly, but of course, we also recruited a group of boys to play against us. Boys who, in the course of our competition, bloodied our noses and elbowed us in the heads and toughened us up in a way that we couldn't get from anywhere else. And that, I think, led to us in great reason why we won the state championship. So grateful for that were we, that when one of us went down, which every day, believe me, one of us did, the rest of us would yell, "Get up!" So scared were we that Mrs. Mulder would walk in. We would be discovered playing with the boys. She was afraid our parents would kill her for letting us play rough with the boys and make us stop. By the time we won the title my senior year, incidentally packing to the rafters with standing room only crowds, the same gym that we weren't allowed to play in 4 years earlier, we were no longer a secret. Now, don't get me wrong, I consider myself incredibly lucky that I was born when I was. I may not have had the same opportunities as my daughter, who had a full-blown satin soccer uniform when she was 5. I think she had her name on it, even. She had really cute accessories with the uniform, by the way. But we finally got the team uniforms that I wanted so badly, albeit made of polyester, so thick, I wrote in my book, that not a drop of sweat dared drip through. You couldn't drive a knife through it. Not that we didn't try in an effort to stretch them out so that we fit into them and they weren't strangling us. But unlike our older sisters and cousins, we had uniforms. We had a team. And we had access to all the amazing life lessons that Christine referred to, that boys were privy to from their first days in Little League. Things like sacrificing for the good of the team, setting goals, leading when able to lead, and following when necessary to follow, negotiating and strategizing. Boys were doing this at ages they didn't even realize they were learning these goals. When we went to a camp, our first basketball camp, we saw cliches all over the walls, and they said things like, "There is no I in team." And we thought it was brilliant. We thought they were the words of Shakespeare, because we never had, you know, those lessons. They weren't cliches to us. It's no coincidence that the last time a survey was done, it was shown that greater than 80% of female Fortune 500 executives in this country played competitive sports at some point in their lives. Again, backing up what Christine was saying, it's no coincidence that I had the courage to choose a profession that still carried a certain stigma for women in the early 80s, and that I would spend the next 30 years with NBA and NFL locker rooms as my office. We played against the boys. Do you think I was going to be scared of the Bears? No. Oh, maybe I was a little scared of the Bears, but not really. Our first coach, Mrs. Mulder, remember her, became pregnant our junior year and went on maternity leave because God knows she couldn't possibly work being pregnant. And the driver's ed teacher and the sophomore boys coach took over, a man. We were right on the brink of the state finals. Mrs. Mulder had taken us to the brink. We got to super sectionals 2 years in a row, which was right before you get to the state tournament. He took us the final step, and we forgot all about Mrs. Mulder. She was never thanked, publicly or otherwise. And because we were kids, we that was my excuse. We just really simply moved on. I won't ruin it for you. If you do get the book, I hope you do. There's an unbelievably poignant scene that made me weep when I was doing the audiobook, which is coming out in a couple weeks. And I think they kept it in, so it's a little embarrassing, but you'll hear me crying because there's a scene that we never knew about. Again, there were so many things we didn't know at the time, but when her involvement with us in the state championship, we thought she was nowhere to be found. But we weren't the only ones who had learned a few things on this journey. So always a natural leader and a motivator, the woman who was not too proud to ask Billy Schnur, the boys' coach, for help, also had no problem 2 years later starting all over again, learning again, asking for help again, and was elected to the Arlington Heights Park Board, where she eventually rose to commissioner and then Park's president for the next 12 years. After two more years as village trustee, Arlene Mulder became the first woman to be elected mayor in the 106-year history of the village. And when she retired in 2012, it was after 5 terms. One of the most popular and respected elected officials in the state of Illinois, and to this day known by presidents for the work that she's done, and internationally for the work she's done with aviation, noise, and so forth. She's my hero. She's the hero of this book. I wish there were more women than her, like her. I wish generations of women after me had been taught by this woman. My book is not about basketball. It's not even really about Title IX. It's certainly Title IX's responsible for the very fact that we were there and everything I just told you. But rather, I'm proud that after many starts and stops, it took me 15 years from that column to getting it published, that it's really the story of one little group of girls. It could have been any little group of girls around the country at this very pivotal time in our history and how our lives were completely transformed by this experience. Wholly responsible for the women that we would become. It's about who I am. And why I became what I became. It's about why I married the man that I married and how we raised our kids. And when I met Birch Bayh, who was the author, a co-author of Title IX, and got to interview him, I blubbered all this to him about how he changed our lives, quite literally. And he thanked me and said, you know, public servants, public officials, what did he say? I don't know the words now. Politicians hope that that's what they do, that they change people's lives, that they affect change. I said, I'm sure people tell you that all the time. He's like, actually, no, not that much. But thanks for telling me. The theme of the book is how basketball saved us. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But I told him that he indeed saved us. Of all the secrets, there is also this, that the first thing I did 15 years ago when I started working on the book was interview a girl named Becky. Becky was a teammate of mine. She was a freshman when I was a senior, and we won the state championship. Becky was essentially bumped me out of the lineup. I had started every year. Senior year, I barely played. Becky bumped me out of the lineup. What I knew about Becky is that her family lived outside of our district, that she should have gone to Niles East, not Niles West. And frankly, I was not thrilled about this. I was a little bitter about this. I figured her father must have pulled strings, her father was a teacher, there must have been some hanky-panky going on. So my first interview with Becky, we're sitting in Panera Bread in Skokie, I said, Becky, you've got to tell me. And she looks at me. She's like, what? I said, was I mean to you? She's like, what? I'm like, no, I mean, well, you know. She goes, Missy, of course not. I looked up to you. I loved you. We laughed. Don't you remember? I'm like, all right, well, good. But Becky, you have to tell me, what was the deal with you going to Niles West? And she said, I still get chills when I tell this story every time. She goes, Missy, you didn't know? And I said, no. And she leaned across the table and she said, Missy, basketball saved me. And that became the mantra and kind of the theme of the book. And I'll just give away the little bit of Becky's story. Her mother, you remember back when we all grew up, right? And your mother would say, you know, the neighbor so-and-so got divorced. You know, so-and-so's sick with whatever. It was a secret. You weren't supposed to know what was going on in other people's houses. My mom would always say, you never know what goes on behind closed doors. You know, the implication that whatever you thought was bad in your house was much worse across the street. So there was a lot of stuff that we didn't know, that I didn't find out until I was an adult. And one of the things, and it's story after story after story, is that Becky's mother was an abusive alcoholic. And that she and her sister, all her mother wanted was two girly girls. What she got was two tomboys. She wasn't happy about this. And her father, who I thought pulled strings, yeah, he pulled strings all right. He went to the school board and begged for Becky to be allowed to come to Niles West because Niles East didn't have a girls' sports program that was developed at that time. And he just wanted to get her out of the house. Well, Becky ended up going to college on a full scholarship for sports. And six of our players went to college on full scholarships. Our star player, who was not in any way thought of in her mind or by us as the star because Mrs. Mulder would not allow it, would not allow one of us to think that way, went on to Northwestern, was a star at Northwestern, and at 5'5", maybe 5'6", got this close to making the 84 Olympic team. And to this day, Connie Erickson is a legend at Niles West. So these girls, to this day, these women inspired the heck out of me. You saw, I don't know if you saw the Today Show clip and you saw a little bit of us as adults holding the banner and stuff. So Connie, the Today Show did this feature on us, which was so cool. And the producer called before they came to town and said, we'd like you to play. We'd like you to have a little scrimmage. And I'm like, yeah, sure, okay. I was all in. I was very excited about this. So I called my friend Connie. I'm like, Connie, you know, they want us to scrimmage. She's like, Missy, I have no meniscus in my knee. I'm not playing. I'm like, oh, stop being a baby so you won't run laterally. You'll go back and forth. She's like, first of all, we played in an old-timers game at Northwestern one year, and it wasn't good, okay? I just say. So we're state champions, damn it, and we have our pride. And I'm, you know, so we all get there, of course. We're all, you know, do the math. It's our 40th anniversary this year, right? So we're in our upper 50s, and we played like you would not believe. I mean, throwing elbows, sweat, and we look good, I have to say. Not just me saying it. I think we look good. And there was about maybe two, in, you know, complete meniscus knees in the whole group. You know, maybe three ACLs. Everyone's knees have gone. But that was one of the great days of my life. That day in the gym was unbelievable. So I again go back to, you know, the secret. Christine mentioned, you know, it was sort of a secret to want to be a sports writer, to tell people. It was certainly not something you shouted from the rooftops when I went to college in the early 80s, but I could not be more proud of my career. Proud to be a journalist, proud to be at Medill. I talk about, you know, the early days constantly with my kids, probably to the point where their eyes glaze over. But all of this is, again, responsible for who I am, who my teammates are. Not all of us, you know, had everything go right in life. Not everything, you know, works out exactly. The odds of life is that one out of the 12 of us on the team were going to be sick. You know, somebody was going to have cancer and somebody was going to run into domestic abuse. There was a chance. And some of us were going to have other issues. And the favorite, my favorite part of the book is the epilogue, because it talks about how it directly impacted us as women and how what we experienced then really got us through the tough times now. So I've been fortunate, but believe me, I've gone back to that well a number of times. So thanks again. I'm sorry if I went on too long. But thank you for listening, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Questions for Missy? I'll let you call them, but I'll
okay,
repeat.
Okay, sure,
them.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read your book.
Thanks. Right, right.
So the question is about, can you talk about the pros and cons of being in an individual athlete sport versus a team sport?
Yeah, I will never say anything negative, nor is there anything negative to say about participating in sports. I will say, after talking about my daughter, and I have a son who's a senior at Northwestern, who's a musician, he played a little bit of soccer. But neither of my kids are big athletes. There's other ways for girls now to get these wonderful skills of teamwork and everything else. They don't have to be athletes. But playing an individual sport, my gosh, it gives you a toughness. To this day, I can't play tennis competitively. I can go out and hit all day long. But if you put a racket in my hand and say serve, and now there's a point and it's up to you, or doubles, I choke almost every time. I didn't choke in team sports. So to have that toughness to know everything's on you, have the self-discipline when people aren't counting on you necessarily every second, to be practicing often by yourself, all of that is a wonderful skill to have. But team sports to me was how I came up, and so that's a wonderful thing. I wouldn't pit one against the other necessarily. I will say, I teach graduate and undergraduate at Medill, and the class I'm teaching this quarter, the first quarter undergrads, 2011 is the course. It's a reporting and writing basic class, and they're so adorable. I love them. They are. They're so wide-eyed, and they're just terrific. And one of them, so they have to do enterprise stories, and one of the women in the class is doing a story on sports specialization versus not. And trainers have just come out. So it used to be great for Christine talked about 16 sports or whatever she did in high school. You know, I played several sports in high school. That was thought to be the way to go. And then all of a sudden, oh no, you better specialize. If you're not playing all year in your one sport, forget about a college scholarship. Not only that, but you're playing for your high school? That's not good enough. You need to be playing for AAU or this club team. I find that really, really disturbing and makes me sad, because I think those kids, boys and girls, are missing out on the unbelievable experience of putting on a high school jersey with your high school's name across your chest and playing for the school. It's wonderful that they're good enough to do that, but some people think that's the only way to get to college. Oftentimes, they don't get to college, to play sports at a big, Division I school that they imagine. The odds are so against it, it's unbelievable. So she's doing this story, and now trainers have just come out from every major sport and said, specialization is not good. It leads to burnout, it leads to more injuries, and that we should hearken back to the old days when kids play multiple sports. So just throwing that in, you didn't ask, but yeah.
What would you estimate the percentage coverage of women's sports, undergraduate and graduate, with the number of women who are getting into sports journalism? How do you see that changing? I mean, there are a lot of women in sports journalism now, and I don't see a lot of coverage of women's sports.
So that question was really about the coverage of women's sports.
Right. Well, I'm going to tell you a story that I'm not that proud of. So I get to the Tribune in 1990, and I was practically handed the Bulls beat. Right in the middle of the Michael Jordan era Bulls, I was the beat writer covering the Chicago Bulls. Now, I had experience up till then, but my gosh. People would ask me, even when I was covering the best team in the world, why aren't you covering women's sports? Why aren't you covering that women's game? And I'd be like, I don't want to cover that women's game. This is the best beat at the paper. And I it was always a bit of guilt for me, because should I put aside my ambitions to have what was considered the best beat at the paper to say, well, I should do more stories on women? Should I be given the story on the quarterback's wife or the coach's wife while I was covering Super Bowls and NBA World Championships? So I made no apologies then. But then life happens, right? And I get caught up in journalism's downfall, if you will. That's too harsh of a word, downfall in numbers. And I'm laid off after 20 years at the Chicago Tribune, which was heartbreaking. I grew up in Chicago. I thought I would die at my desk at the Tribune. So I'm laid off in 2009. I somehow hook on to ESPN. Things are going pretty well. I'm in the Chicago office. And then I get a call. The Chicago office might be, we don't know for sure, but we'd like you to work for ESPNW. I had never heard of ESPNW at the time. That's the women's sports site. And so I hung up the phone, and I was still covering the Bulls and the Bears and the Cubs and the Sox and the Blackhawks for ESPN Chicago. So I wasn't sure what to make of this ESPNW. And I hung up the phone, and my daughter walks up, and she's a teenager, and she goes, "Oh, Mom, I'm so sorry." And I thought, oh, boy, where did I fail her, you know? She thought this was a really terrible thing in my career, that now I had to cover women. And I'm not just saying this. It was the most satisfying part of my career, covering women's sports, in the next several years that I did. I covered tennis throughout my career, but it wasn't until then that I exclusively covered women's tennis. So I got to know Serena Williams and Venus Williams and Lindsay Davenport, all these players, you know, very well, and covered women's golf, which no one covers. And I really, truly appreciated it, and I really appreciate the work that ESPNW is doing. Do I wish that all of my women students in sports writing, I also teach that, go on and only cover women's sports? Am I going to wish on them, you know, what I didn't aspire to do because I was aspiring to get the best beat at the paper? No. What can I tell you? But I wish that, you know, part of it's space consideration. So when I was at the Tribune, we covered DePaul women's basketball like crazy. I don't know how many of you remember the name Bill Jouse, but he was a wonderful sports writer, and he covered men's basketball, but he insisted on covering women's basketball. And the women's DePaul team, coached by Doug Bruno, is one of the best and is perennially being one of the best in the country. And Bill insisted on covering them, and so we, as a beat, covered them. But well, we had the space to do that in the paper. We don't have that anymore. That's one of the excuses given. It's a shame that the Chicago Sky isn't given very much coverage at all. You know, I covered them for many years. I went sort of embedded with them when they started the franchise. I spent almost a year with Michael Alter going around the country and looking at other teams and how they decided. He still is losing money with this WNBA team after almost 20 years. He's an unbelievable guy that he's willing to still, you know, be in it for this long without making a profit. So are you going to tell him if he sells the team he's a bad guy because he couldn't make them flow? He can't make people cover the WNBA like they should. So, yeah, it's really like a conundrum. I know I answered really long. But it's obviously close to my heart because I wish there was more coverage. And you can't just say, well, win and we'll cover you. Because they did win. The Sky did win. And the Tribune and the Sun-Times didn't cover them. And TV stations didn't cover them. So I don't know what to tell you. You know, the women's lacrosse team at Northwestern got pretty good coverage. Why? Because Philip Hirsch from the Chicago Tribune took an intense interest in them, and he covered them like crazy. Again, he insisted. He went to the sports center. This is a great story. So he traveled with them to the national championships. I'm not sure we would do that. So maybe the answer is we just need more. We do need women who want to cover sports, who want to cover women, and who fight for it. You know. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
I was a captain on the men's crew team in college.
Oh, cool.
Team, so I understand, and it was strictly a choice. They get better resources, they have more money, everything. And I think that it's always following the money. And
yeah.
If you look at the Women's World Cup, they earned a quarter of what the men's team won. And until you see more equalization in terms of resources and money.
Yeah. Yeah, people often ask me, like, you know, What changes have you seen since you were in high school? Which is, believe me, I'm not going to answer that question because we'll be here forever. But my short answer is this, that if you would have asked me in 1979 as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, after winning the state championship, after being on WGN, it was just a super station nationwide, after winning the state and being invited to the governor's office and all this cool stuff and packing the gym and going on a parade and having all the kids finally rally around us, because believe me, it took up until then for them to do that. If you would have said, in 40 years, there are going to be women who are going to play soccer before hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children watching them, packed stadiums will watch these women and cheer them. What would I have said? I would have been like, well, yeah, of course. And there's a woman president, and like I'll be the GM of the Bulls, and like, yeah, I would not have been shocked at all. But if you would have said these same women will be suing for equal pay, and that when they win the World Cup, their fans will be chanting for equal pay, we would have been devastated. We would have been devastated 40 years ago to hear that we're still fighting these battles. So it's very disappointing that we're still having these conversations, that I'm not the GM of the Bulls, and I probably never will be, not because I'm not qualified, but because I'm a woman.
I think we can get one more question. Yeah. You got one in the second row here.
Yeah.
Do you feel that media plays a factor into creating that buzz so that people will want it? Do we play to people's desires to see it? And then as a society, do we not value women's sports as much as men?
What is the drivers of interest in women's sports?
It's a fabulous question because, you know, everybody thinks like mostly men watch sports in this country. It's not true at all. Half the country, maybe even more than half, are women who watch these sports, so I'll put it in the lap of women as well. But I'll use the WNBA as an example. When you watch the game on TV, and you watch the WNBA, and you watch the NBA, you see the NBA, the men, playing above the basket, above the rim, right? It's an incredibly athletic game that's played up here. When you watch the women, their fundamentals are often just as good, sometimes better. They're better free throw shooters. The game looks slower. The game looks smaller. So therefore, men judge it by that. Mostly men and women say, eh, okay. But the Phoenix Mercury had a great idea a couple years ago, and they said, we're going to give anybody a ticket for free if you just give us a chance. Just come to the arena. If you go to a WNBA game, and I'm telling you guys, if you have time, if you have a day in the summer, go to Wintrust Arena. The games are spectacularly played. They're so competitive. They're on such a high level. They play phenomenally well. In person, it's a great game. And if you get people to come, men and women, to give it a chance, they'll be hooked and they'll watch. And it won't look the same way on TV. But it's hard to do. It's hard to convince somebody to go to an LPGA event, even though it's, again, the same thing. The short game's phenomenal. But they're playing on a shorter tee, and they don't drive as far, and it doesn't look as impressive. You can watch women's tennis, though, and that's, that's just as exciting. So there are some exceptions. But I think largely, that's it. They won't give it a chance. They won't give it a chance, so...
Well, encouraging us to give us a chance is a nice way to end. Please join me in thanking Melissa Isaacson.
Thanks. Thank you.
It's always awkward to end someone speaking when it's my turn, but it occurs to me that I'll have to point out a couple of differences between Christine and Missy and myself. They're both the youngest of four, and Christine said she was the oldest of four. I'm an only child, so I'm very good at getting my turf. And I played no sports. We moved into a new building recently, and the doorman said to me, You look very athletic. What did you play? And no one has ever given me that nice of a compliment. I was an art major in college. And so I consider that. So to follow this act of sports, I fear I'm going to take you right back to the classroom. There's going to be slides. We're going to talk about politics. So I probably should not have been last. But the truth is, I tried to get out of doing this, and Shirley wouldn't let me. I thought we could have a whole day about sports. But I'm going to kind of try to take this home. And since I have had the privilege of being with you all year, I'm going to try to draw some threads together that sort of inspired what I'm going to talk about today, but also potentially connect back to some of the things some of the other speakers have talked about. I won't get to all of them. That's on me, but in an attempt to try to do this well, thank you so much. I'll do some of them. As many of you know about me, my area of expertise is really the media. So I study the psychology of media use, why people watch what they watch on television, why they do what they do on their phones, why they read what they read. And my ultimate goal with my career is how do we get people to consume higher quality information about issues that really matter in the world. Now, I want to tell you, that comes from someone who watches a whole lot of Hallmark Channel this time of year. So I think sometimes people get afraid of me, like if I haven't read The New Yorker or I'm not up on The Atlantic, I better not talk to Rachel. The truth is, we all need a release. We all get it in different ways. This good Jewish girl, I love some traditional Hallmark Channel Christmas movies. I don't know why, I just love them. They always end well. He's always a prince. I always turn to my husband and say, we've been married 18 years. You've got to be the king of something, and I haven't known about it. You know, I'm certain it's going to happen. So it gives you a good sense. I don't want you to think that all of it's about news, but that's really what I study. But you were introduced through the dean of Kellogg to the idea of sort of what happens when you advance in your careers. What she didn't get an opportunity to say is kind of what do you get to do when you get promoted? And I'm very fortunate that this year I earned promotion to full professor, which has been a great, thank you. Thank you. I'm working on using my action words, like Vicky told us. I earned, I led, right? So I earned a promotion to full professor, and I really spent some time thinking about what am I going to do with that? I'm 41. I have the good center of my career left. What am I going to do with that promotion? And I started to think about the idea of there's kind of what's going on in the world, and what do I know that could contribute to a solution, but what do I not know? You heard a little bit of that from Annalise last week about the idea that universities are the opportunity to bring people together. One of the really unique things about Northwestern is that we're a school of this status that has a journalism school, but we also have a school of education and social policy. Many, many universities just have schools of public policy. We have a school of education and social policy. So the idea was, I sort of thought there are bigger questions at the intersection of these issues that we could begin to answer. So I really sat down and thought, okay, what do I know? This is going to be what I normally talk about for 2 hours in 7 minutes. These are kind of the things that I know from my research. So we know local news models are failing. Missy referred to that when she talked about getting laid off from the Chicago Tribune. 1,800 local newspapers have closed in the last 15 years, leaving 20% of communities in this country with low local newspaper. We've certainly seen the rise of the New York Times and the Washington Post get so much attention right now. Kind of what we see is the Trump backlash subscriptions. It's the idea people feel like they need to be informed. That really is the exception to the rule. All of you who used to get local newspapers at your home should notice they're getting smaller and smaller. The staffs are getting smaller and smaller. There's less coverage of things like the strike than there would have been had it happened 20 years ago. So local news models have been failing for a long time, primarily because people aren't willing to pay for news. News habits of elites vary from the rest of us. So I'm working on a book on the news habits of elites. And just so you all know, you're in and I'm in, so it's not a criticism of you. If it's a criticism of anyone, it's a criticism of all of us. The reality is, news elites consume more high-quality information than the rest of the American electorate. News elites in this country pay full price subscriptions for the New York Times, the Atlantic, your cable subscription, all the things that fund information in this country. You might donate to PBS, you might donate to WTTW, you might listen to NPR. I love, was it you who brought up NPR? I think it actually was Christine. She said a third of people in this country have no idea what NPR is. When we do brand recognition, a third of people in this country have no idea what NPR is. Now, I want you to think about that even if you're not a regular NPR listener, just kind of thinking elites in this country are NPR people. So what's happening is that gap between elites and the rest of the country is growing. People consume news to feel good about their social identities. So I spent my career really on the idea that people have both personal and social identities. Your personal identity is the things like you take a Myers-Briggs test or any kind of, you know, what career are you going to be good at when you grow up, if you ever took those when you were younger. That's your personal identity. You can change metrics on that, but you have to work really hard to do it. It's often a good idea to get a coach or get a counselor to help you. Social identities are very different. We come in and out of social identities all the time. They're reflected in what we wear, the language we use, how we wear our hair, the topics we discuss. The things I talk about with my mother are different than the things I talk about with my friends. They're very different than the things I talk about with my husband. And you may catch yourself with this. Have you ever thought about something? You're like, I'm just not going to discuss that with somebody because I just... That's really your social identity, regulating your relationship with other people. The key reason we consume media is to feel good about one of those social identities. So I use this example all the time about millennials. No wonder millennials stopped reading the newspaper, because every newspaper article about millennials said they were dumb. Do you remember those headlines? Or lazy. Millennials are dumb and lazy. And you wonder why a millennial doesn't want to read that? Can you imagine if they wrote something about that, about something that was important to you? So all of a sudden, we know people watch and pay attention to things to feel good about their social identities. That's actually not a bad thing. We just have to understand it as a motivating principle. Social media rewards volume producers. So in a world that has left a lot of newspapers for things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, the reality is you pick the people that you follow, yes, but the algorithm rewards people who post frequently. On Instagram is the best way for me to help you think about that. Of the top 10 news producers who post on Instagram, the average posts in a month are 163. Fox News posts 400 times a month on average and has an audience 6 times the size of the next largest audience after them. See, the idea is the more you post, the more the stream wants to reward you because they need content to be successful. Facebook is nothing if you don't put something there. I took my birthday off Facebook. You know how many people forgot when it was? Right? You learn it. Take your birthday off Facebook. You'll realize who your friends are. If you're busy around your birthday, trust me, your schedule will clear right up. No problem. That's if content is not there. There's nothing for them to publish. So publishers of social media reward volume. And volume doesn't discriminate. You could decide tomorrow, I'm going to be a volume producer. I'm just going to get out there and I'm going to share pictures of my kids, my grandkids, my ski vacation, whatever it is. Ultimately, volume wins on social media. So now all of a sudden, we don't have as much control over the content that you see in front of you as we did when you all read the Chicago Tribune, or you all watched the McNeil Lair NewsHour, or whatever it was, where we had some sort of sense to make sure we were all getting the same narrative. Finally, and this is kind of a new piece of my work, need for affect. Need for affect is the idea that you need confirmation. You need some kind of feeling, in essence, you did well on that test, Jimmy. I'm so proud of you. You put the trash in the trash can. That kind of need for young people to have positive affirmation of what they're doing. We see that going up. This should be no surprise based on what you kind of see happening in schools and with young people today. The reality is there's a consequence for news, though. As need for affect goes up, so if someone needs more positive reinforcement, they also are more likely to think they are correct, even with less information. So to have no... Have you ever been in an argument with somebody and you think, you don't even know what you're arguing about? Why do you have such a strong feeling about it? That really is the consequence, typically, of someone who has a high need for affect. I'm going to go to the mat over this, even though I don't know any facts about it. I'm going to tell you, you guys are all going to be shocked. This is why I wear a blazer. I get so hot. I'm so excited to talk to you. This is why I never really did well on television news, because you have to cover your arms or you look enormous. And I was always, and the lights are on, and I'm always sweating. And then they would always say, Rachel, wipe your brow. I'm like, you're going to have to get a handkerchief. I mean, I'm going to start dripping on the floor. So ultimately, we have a real challenge. Now, we know people want to feel good about themselves. We know elites have pretty good news habits, but they don't represent a whole bunch of the population. The quality of what's in front of you is really being controlled by volume producers. And we're seeing more and more people willing to think they know what they're talking about without any facts. So you think we have a problem of polarization? I sort of say we got a whole lot of problems between the poles, if you will. This is not in any particular party or any particular group of people. These are things that are sort of facing us as a society. So I said, okay, I know something. Those are the things I know. But if I'm really interested in how do we increase the quality of conversation in this country, so my goal is how do we have better conversations about things we disagree about. Many of you know my background. I was raised in a household with a very conservative father. I almost brought my parents' wedding picture, but I didn't ask their permission. And my dad is out hunting in Idaho. That's how conservative my father is. My dad is out hunting in Idaho, and I couldn't get in touch with him. The only thing is, I talked to him 2 days ago, and he told me they did not have running water for a week. I don't even know how that works when you're out hunting with, like, five guys. But my dad, I'm 41. My dad has never killed anything, so I don't actually think they go hunting. I was like, how's it going? Haven't seen an elk yet. I'm like, okay. Literally, my dad has never shot a thing. So we're all in good stead. But I grew up in a household. My father was in the military. My father was very conservative. He grew up in a Southern Baptist family. My mom is quite liberal. My mom grew up in Los Angeles. My mom got thrown out of Berkeley for protesting the Vietnam War. My mom's Jewish. I've sort of already intimated that. So I grew up in a household that fights a lot. And it was always ended with, we're just going to agree to disagree. We have never yet settled an argument in the Davis household. So I have this career where I sort of think, like, how can we have a good conversation? I'm actually really comfortable with conflict, as you might expect, growing up in a house like that. But I want to be able to really hear what you're saying, and I actually want to end with, let's kind of find a compromise in the middle. That's sort of the difference. So I said, okay, what can we do to kind of merge these fields? And the reality is, I think the most interesting questions facing kind of the electorate today fall in the center here. The idea is there's something going on with media. I introduce you to that. There's obviously something going on in our political landscape, both how politicians interact with the world and how we interact with politicians that's changing. And when we think about civic learning, the idea of how do you figure out what it means to be a citizen, not in the sense of, like, do you have a U.S. passport, but what does it mean to be a good person in your community? We have a lot of lessons in that, but they mostly all look like U.S. government lessons. They're not necessarily as tangible as the things as you stand up when someone walks on the bus and they're pregnant. You know, they're not always those kind of normative things that many of us think kind of makes someone a good person. So I was fortunate enough, you may remember from that very first week that I was with you, you met four scholars from the Institute of Policy Research. I enjoy an appointment at the Institute of Policy Research, and it really has been formative in my work. And I sat and I said, okay, well, who do I know who kind of knows something I don't know, and could we get together? And I love being able to share this with you in a moment that we've been talking about women all year. And so I went to Laurel Harbage Young. Laurel is a faculty member in the Department of Political Science, and she studies how state officials interact with their constituents. So she studies websites, newsletters, e-newsletters, kind of the action that happens between state officials and their constituents. Stephanie Edgerly is actually in Medill, but the reason I went to Stephanie, I think, is really important as we think about this elite piece. I was very fortunate to chair the search committee that hired Stephanie. We recruited her away from the University of Wisconsin. Stephanie is the first person in her family to go to college. She went on to earn a master's degree and a PhD. She is the first Hispanic woman ever to be tenured at the Medill School of Journalism. She really represents, as we talk about the kind of what's going on and the difference between elites and the rest of the population, she studies what's going on with the rest of the population. I spend a lot of time studying how do we make news products better that end up getting consumed by this many people. Stephanie studies what do people even think is news in the first place. So she spends a lot of time really studying overcame that gap from the other side of the coin. So the three of us sat down, and I will tell you the one secret, if you don't know this already, the way to get a bunch of faculty members into a room is to offer to buy them lunch. That's true when they're graduate students. It's true when they become faculty members. And so we were really fortunate. You don't need to know the names on here, but I just wanted to give you a sense of what we did. We sat down, and we said, we don't even know the right questions to ask. We ordered pita in. That's a that pita in does not deliver it like that, but that's their delivery photo. So pita in is a big hit with Northwestern faculty. Should you ever need to get anything out of a Northwestern faculty member, it turns out pita in is the ticket. So we got $1,000 from the provost's office on the argument that Northwestern has an opportunity to do something really interesting at the intersection of media, politics, and civic learning. We just have no idea what it is. And we were really honest about that, because the truth is, I didn't even understand the whole problem. And so the provost agreed to give us $1,000 to have a few lunches. We got this group of faculty members together who'd all kind of touched civic education or media and politics in some way, was thinking about how do we improve the quality of conversation in this country. And we started to both talk about what are the unanswered questions, but also to listen to the work of everyone on this list. So we got together, and everyone on this list gave a lecture about what it is that we do. Because one of the very difficult challenges, like you heard from Annalise, is universities can often live in very deep silos. So I know what's happening in my institution, but I don't necessarily know what's happening in the School of Education and Social Policy. So we made a real effort to do this. And I want to draw attention to a couple people on this list, because I think it's really important. One, Beth Redbird was the first Native American scholar we hired after the university's commitment to grow in Native American scholarship. Beth studies how people understand the economy. And she does it by using vignettes of, like, say, going to a Starbucks or having an experience in a restaurant. And she'll ask people on that kind of income and elite scale, how many people were in that Starbucks? And it's interesting to know, elites often leave out the person who takes their money, the person who cooked the muffin. And many other people in our society will say there were four people. They're counting themselves, the person behind them online, and the two people behind the counter. So she studies the idea of sort of how do people think about their social position in the economy. Now, you can start to see why that would be of interest for me, but something I don't know a whole lot about. Beth also grew up near a reservation, so she understands a different lifestyle than I had as a child. So that's a good example of the types of people we tried to get into the room. Jessica Holman is a computer science faculty member. Jessica, we just hired. Jessica studies the how we document lack of knowledge, lack of specificity. So you can think about that related to the last election, where we have a kind of margin of error around votes for, at the time, Clinton versus Trump. She studies how do we best visualize that so it makes sense, because most Americans don't understand what margin of error means. So that's a good example of how different disciplines potentially came to bear in what we were talking about. We sat, we talked with each other, we did it a lot, we ate a lot of pita in, and we really came down to this fundamental question. Researchers are very good at studying the behaviors of elites and how present they are in other people. So, for example, we will ask people, did you vote in the last election? And about 20 years ago, we figured out voting is not the only important thing. And so we started asking other questions, like, do you sign petitions? Have you marched for a cause? Have you donated to a cause? So we've sort of expanded the way we think about citizenship in the way we ask you, do you do this behavior in survey research? But the reality is, what we realized very quickly is it leaves off a lot of things that people think defines their citizenship. I've given you one example here. We hear it again and again from respondents. I take my trash to the curb when it's supposed to, and I pull it in when it's supposed to come in, and I don't leave it out, and that makes me a good neighbor. I'll give you another example. Many people will say, I send my kid to school clean and with lunch. I'm a good person. Many people will say, we talked to one person who said, yesterday, my neighbors had a party, and their music was too loud, and I did not call the police. And that makes me a good neighbor. Now, to us, you're like, but did you vote? right? I mean, the votes, what really matters. Are you registered? One of the real challenges is we have somewhat a narrow definition of how people relate to their communities, and it tends to be defined by fairly elite practices. You have to have a certain comfort level and a certain income level to show up to a rally, to donate to a cause. And so what we've realized is our conceptualization of citizenship has been narrow and fairly defined by elite practices. Now, that's not universally true, but it's enough true that we don't have a sense of really what's going on with the electorate. And people on this list made the point, if I really understood how people related to their communities, this Matt Easterday does programs for teaching how we teach citizenship in schools. Matt's argument is if I knew how someone related to their community, I could do a better job of creating course material so they know how to do that better, moving them up their own scale of efficacy. I'm not trying to turn everyone into me. I want you to be a slightly better citizen. And one of the real challenges, people always get skeptical, but don't you want everyone to vote? And I am going to pick on my parents here a little, and I didn't ask their permission, and we are recording it, but just don't put it on social media. My father, I told you, was in the Navy. My dad did 30 years in the nuclear Navy. We moved quite a bit, and for those of you who've never been connected to a military family, you are allowed to keep your citizenship in your home state so that you as a military family are not like having to re-register your car and get driver's license when you move every 2 years. My parents were residents of California for all the years that I was growing up. When I got ready to go to college, I was in high school in Virginia. My father said to me, well, you're never getting into UCLA or UC Berkeley out of state. And you're definitely, wait, in-state. You're not smart enough to get into UC Berkeley or UCLA as an in-state student. And you're not smart enough to get into UVA out of state. So you better pick somewhere else. So it gives you a sense of, like, who my dad is. Thankfully, my parents, despite a military career, had saved and were able to help me go to college. But I went to Wake Forest, not a shabby place to go to college. And I met my husband there. So, I told you my father has very conservative views and my mom has very liberal views. Every year that I remember growing up, my parents didn't vote. Because absentee ballots were complicated back then. You know, it wasn't as easy as getting online and requesting an absentee ballot. And you know what they said? I won't vote if you don't vote because we're just going to cancel each other out anyway. Now, I want you to think about that in the sense, like in some ways I'm embarrassed to tell you that story. In other ways, my dad gave this country 30 years of his life. My father, when something happens in the government, calls me up and tells me about what it's like to fight for the Constitution and how elites like me cannot relate to it, and then he reads me something from the Constitution, and then he hangs up the phone. I mean, this is someone who deeply, deeply loves this country, right? But they made a decision out of practicality for all kinds of reasons, and for whatever judgment you have, and your judgment may be harsher than mine, they're my parents and I love them. Think about all the reasons people don't necessarily engage in the elite's version of connecting with a community. So if I'm just going to badger my parents over the head, you have to vote, you have to vote, maybe that's not really the point. Maybe the point is, maybe you should talk to other people in the military about registering, or people who live here, or maybe they should have done a little more to think about, Rachel, you should register to vote, right? Like, what are the things on the dial that are movable for somebody like that? It's not always just one linear definition. So, to give you a sense of sort of what that looks like at scale, this is the only super nerdy thing I'm going to show you. What this shows you, actually, and this goes to kind of the discourse and the way we think about elites in this country. This is a little bit complicated, but I'm going to show you the following. So this is how liberal or conservative people are on economic issues. So if they're down at this -1, they're more liberal on economic issues. And if they're up here at this +1, they're more conservative. Up and down here, this is the social issues, how liberal or conservative someone is on social issues. So if they're down here in the bottom, they're more liberal on social issues. If they're up here at the top, they're more conservative on social issues. So that, it should not surprise you that the blues fall where the blues fall and the reds fall where the reds fall. So these are people who voted for Clinton in the last national election who fell on the spectrum of economically and socially liberal. These reds up here in this quadrant are people who voted for Trump, who are economically conservative and socially conservative. What I want to point out to you that's not as obvious because this aggregates a lot of data points. Elites in this country, and this may not apply to you, but the preponderance of elites in this country actually fall in this quadrant that has very few people in it altogether. Elites in this country tend to be economically conservative and socially liberal. So it is to say, it's a complicated way if we only think about elites' dimension of how do we move forward? How do we educate people to understand policy issues? We have to understand people where they are. We have to start with people where they are right now and asking them, are you registered to vote or are you not registered to vote? We don't think is the best mechanism. Now, I should have probably told you in the beginning of all this is a bit of a risk for me to tell you this, but when Vicky Calagara got up here and said, 6 years ago I was telling you about a telescope, and now I'm telling you about the greatest astrological finding of the last century, I feel like I can say, I'm talking to you about something that is just starting, and maybe I'll be back in 6 years to tell you we've changed the face of the world. What we're doing now, we have $5,000 from the Alumni Association. For those of you who are members, thank you. We are now starting a statewide study of what we're calling civic capital and your relationship with democratic institutions. I want to expand how you might initially think of democratic institutions to include libraries, public schools, the DMV, all the ways we interact with places. Libraries are a great example of something many elites don't interact with because we can buy it from Amazon, but libraries become a very important home as weather changes, as you need access to information, if you need access to the internet, if you need access to job support. So we are beginning to undertake the idea, how can we understand different dimensions of civic identity, not just identified through the mechanisms through which we determine as elites, and the relationships to democratic institutions. So the real goal is not just to understand what people are doing, but the real goal is to say, for these type of people, the library needs to do this. And for this group of people, public schools need to do that. And for this type of people, the senator is more effective to communicate this way. That's really our end game, is to help people in schools, in politics, and in the media understand how more effective ways of communication can happen. So I'm sorry that fell off out of order there, but these are all the things we're looking at, and you can notice, this is how you can tell this is very nascent work, because I get to just have other, but the idea, it's just sort of like, if I forgot it, it fell under other. The idea really is, we're going to start studying, not just, are you voting, are you registered to vote, but we're going to study things like your economic power. Not just how much you make, but what do you have the efficacy to deal with? Where do you feel like you have influence or not have influence over? Missy brought up the example of, you know, could I influence what public school my kid goes to? We know there's some ways to do that, but that is not always available to everyone. Are you aware of the charter schools in your community? Do you feel like you can send your child there? The role of institutions, I talked to you broadly about that in library. Education, we know, is a big part of how people think about their relationship to places and spaces. Status, that doesn't just include your status as a formal citizen, although that's a very important fact going into our next census, but also your status as, are you a blue-collar worker? Are you an hourly worker? How are you wage-dependent? You know, kind of all of the things that we think about as being important as we categorize people. Geography is obviously important. You saw this play out after our last election as we started to see the urban-rural divide. And you heard a lot about that. Remember Beth Tipton back talking about the difference? We've been overstudying schools in urban areas, and we've left out kind of the big swath of the country. We've done the same thing with media outlets. We know a lot about what's going on with the Chicago Tribune. We do not know a whole lot about what's going on in Omaha. Right? That's been because there's a great journalism school here and the Chicago Tribune is here and it's a lot easier for us to do it. And I can make a really good argument to a funder. The Chicago Tribune touches many more people. So if you want bang for your buck, you should fund research in an urban community. So geography becomes really important. Beliefs, obviously, as you start to think, I gave my dad as an example, kind of, are you a constitutionalist? I won't give my dad any of your phone numbers because he'll start calling you and reading you the Constitution too. You know, placement and behavior in a network? Are you a leader? Do you share information? And does it get picked up and shared with other people? I told you my father's from a very conservative family. My father's sister is still alive, and she's become much more conservative as she's aged. She doesn't get out very much, so a lot of the consequences of isolation have really hurt her. So she has a home health aide who she met through church, who has been really involved in her life. And Betsy is her name. She's been great to my aunt, and I'm very grateful for her. But let me just say, we have very different beliefs about the world. Betsy's birthday was the other day, and it popped up on my Facebook feed. And so I went into her Facebook feed, and I made the biggest mistake I've ever made in my life. I started following the things that she posted. And I often will say to people, fake news is not something you really need to worry about. Fake news is touching about 2% of people in this country. But when you see it in someone's feed, you sort of think to yourself, oh, you know, when you know something is an incorrect fact, and it's salacious in the way it's presented in a meme. And Betsy's feed is filled with all this misinformation. But never more than 2 people liked it. And in many cases, somebody in her network is correcting it. Someone in her network is saying, that photo did not take place there. That photo is 30 years old. Here's the site. You know what? I can live with that. It may not change Betsy's mind, but it's a great example. It's very different than someone who shares inaccurate information. It spreads without correction, or it spreads so far before correction, we're not able to get it back in the kind of the genie in the bottle. And then that big other attributes category, to give you a sense of what we mean by other attributes, one is how much you travel seeing the world, how much you think about sort of your obligation to state. How do you feel about service to country? You know, did you have anyone in your family who fought, was, you know, in the service? You know, so there are a number of other things we're thinking about. Did you take your trash to the corner? I mean, we've got to think about all of those things and how they factor in to the decisions that we make about what we ask. So what we're planning to do in the state of Illinois is we're going to do a really small sample survey. So we're going to go out and we're going to model this at a very small scale to see if we can be successful. The goal is to develop typologies of individuals so that we understand them on their scale of citizenship, not on our scale of citizenship. And the best way to think about this, if you've ever heard when we cover elections, we'll say things like the soccer moms are voting for so-and-so and the conservative dads. You know how they often categorize people? That's typologizing. Actually, politics have been really good at this for a long time. We want to use it for a little more social good, right? And again, our goal is to understand everyone on their scale and then how we're going to move them up their scale, not switch them to ours. I mean, I think that's what you're going to hear this group really committed to. Identity fell off there, but I think you know what that says. So here's what we think we're going to be able to answer. We think we're going to be able to understand how people interact with and process information. That becomes really important for media producers. How long does it need to be? How short does it need to be? Is it a good idea to put news on Instagram? You know, we think we're going to be able to understand the way information interacts with different groups of people. How existing views resist change. So we have a researcher, David Rapp, in the School of Education and Social Policy, who specifically studies the idea, how kind of strident are your views? And how do we get you to move along the scale, especially if your views are factually inaccurate? What kinds of importance do people place on information as characteristic of a good citizenship? The entire journalism industry believes that you all think we're the most important thing in your citizenship life. And the reality is, the most important thing in your citizenship life is probably your family. And so journalists have a really, really strong sense that you need us, and why are you not paying for us, and what's wrong with you? Part of what we need to understand is how many people value information as a part of that process, and what does that information look like? It may be that we need better information, I'm going to go out on a limb here, about public schools than we need about a lot of things newspapers have decided to double down on and cover. How people judge the veracity of information, the role of technology in the presentation of that information. We're obviously very concerned about what we see in social media and the idea that people are kind of believing what they see before they check it. We're trying to understand what typologies are the most vulnerable to that. If we understand the typologies that are the most vulnerable to that, we think we can make a difference in helping do better education where they are about how to avoid those traps. how civic institutions might better serve individual civic efficacy. I gave you that example about libraries, but there are many other institutions. One you might have dealt with recently, the TSA, is trying to do a better job of saying, don't forget, you need to get your real ID, right? That's a civic institution that you're having some interaction with that's basically saying, go down to the DMV and make sure you get your real ID. And the consequences of blurring the lines between news and entertainment. I told you Stephanie really studies what do people think of news in the first place. It'll frighten you what people think is news. People think the Hallmark Channel is news. People think, you know, that becomes the real challenge in the marketplace. As more and more becomes blurred about the difference, by the way, part of this is on the news business. In an effort to get you to pay attention, we wear more scandalous things. We yell at you a little louder. We put splashier graphics on the screen. So this is not all to blame on the entertainment side of the coin, but the real challenge is this has become much more blurred, and it's much more blurred for different typologies than it is for others. That's the piece that we think we can really make a difference in. So we're working really hard on kind of getting this pilot study off the ground. Our group is called Civic Capital and Democratic Institutions. We're kind of, as you might sense, we're in the fundraising stage now, the idea of kind of how do we support this work. But I think we have, I hope we'll have exciting results, maybe not to share with you next year. You'll be bored of me by then. But I hope we have really valuable results to share with you in 5 years. And I hope this gives you a sense of what universities are capable of if we work across disciplinary boundaries, which is really what Annalise talked about. And for those people who say to me, Rachel, why should Northwestern give you a job for life? Well, there's something about job security that gives you the time to slow down and get other people together and support their careers. And admittedly, the tenure clock is not very favorable to that. So early in my career, it was all about churning out things that were going to get me over the mountain. It really is a beautiful moment when you get to slow down and say, okay, who else? Not only who else can I get over the mountain, you know, how can we diversify the voices in the room, but how can we solve problems that I couldn't solve on my own? And universities are in a very unique position to do that. And so I thought it would be helpful to sort of introduce you to that, even though it's very early work, to give you a sense of how Northwestern and the support that you give us kind of brings all these things together. So thank you for that, and I'm happy to take your questions with kind of the last 10 minutes we have left.
Yep.
It seems as though, you know, communication is getting easier and easier for people to digest. You know, how can journalism, someone like you in the university world, come up with ways to increase dialogue one-on-one to benefit?
So that question was really about kind of how can we help outlets at the very, very small local level? So we've seen a tremendous amount of entrepreneurship at the small local level, which has been really valuable. Here are a couple things that I would say, though. One is, how do we deal with information glut, right? So we have a faculty member on that list, Nick Diakopoulos, who often says to me, you know, there's just how do we know when too much information is too much? Like, we know when you've eaten too much Thanksgiving, right? You know what that feels like. We're not great at the metric of what's too much information. And so one of the big challenges for local news, very local news, is how do we penetrate what you need to know at a local level with the frequency that you need to know it? So for example, local news, there often isn't really important news every day. Right? Like, there isn't always important things happening on your block or your sector every day, however you think about your neighborhood. But a lot of local producers feel like, well, I got to do something every day. So then they end up putting out something that was just pointless, you know, or not really about my local area. So then I get annoyed and I don't click to open it the next day. So one thing that we often say in the news business, one size does not fit all. And this is a great example for women. Do you remember when, like, companies used to say one size fits all and you would hold up that T-shirt and I thought, not me. Like, that thing is like this size. That is definitely not going over those. So ultimately, oh, I forgot to tell you my biggest news of the day. In a room of women and videotape, I have been trying to get into these purple pants since we started 8 weeks ago. And I was like, I'm going to get into the purple pants. I want you to know, They fit, but it is just too darn cold to wear them. Like the outfit that it went with. But next time you invite me back, I'm going to fit in those purple. I bought the most like perfect shade of purple pants and I was holding them for today and like the weather betrayed me. So my point is to say that local news, people like me help you understand how local news kind of, what is the frequency? What is the pattern of behavior? What makes you likely to click that can help them do that with some regularity? There are two things that are working really well right now in the news business. E-newsletters are working well, although time of day and length are a big issue. Just when I tell you e-newsletters work, everyone then comes to me and says, here's my 1,800-word newsletter. And I think those are not working. That's not what I mean. And then interestingly, the second thing, and Shirley got us on this jig early in the quarter, I'm a professor. Podcasts are working well. So podcasts are working, you know, they're succeeding mostly in an elite marketplace, but podcasts are certainly a new form of storytelling that we haven't seen before. Yeah, so that question was about the controversy about political ads on Twitter. I did a lot of press after that, and the truth of the matter is, while I applaud any effort to improve the quality of information, I think there's two key issues. People who want political ads off Twitter will often say, but I don't want ads about, you mean, there should be able to be what we call issue ads, like save the environment or save women's health centers. Turns out, are those going to be qualified as political ads? Technically, we would call them political. So one of the big challenges is kind of what is the domain of political, and is that really going to fix the issue you want to fix? The second thing is, and I've said this in a lecture to the Northwestern Women's Board, but I'll say it here. I do think inaccurate ads are a problem. But I think inaccurate information from public officials is a bigger problem. And we have no rule against that. And I'm not trying to pick on any one political party. I love to use as an example. Things happen. The Jussie Smollett example is a great example of inaccurate information when, now, ultimately, about a third of the population still thinks that Jussie Smollett was assaulted in Chicago. So that's a great example of something that then changes the image of our community in the way it interacts with a certain with groups of people, because the information was inaccurate at one point, it got corrected, but not everyone got both, or people don't always believe the correction. So I applaud the effort to get political ads. The more money we can get out of politics, probably the better, but to get political ads off social media, but I don't think it's going to have this rampant positive effect that we think. Yes?
When I pick up the paper, I pretty much believe what I read. Mm-hmm. But with podcasts, and I don't understand, how do I know what's coming over? How do I trust?
So here's my biggest advice to you. Follow podcasts from the newspapers that you trust. So if you trust the Times, listen to the Daily. If you trust the Washington Post, listen to the Post reports. Yet you don't. The truth is you don't. It's like picking up any magazine, and the only way to do it is to look back through things they've covered in the past and to say, does that resonate with me? I mean, you've got to give things the smell test, right? I mean, I think that's the reason you trust newspapers is because they've gotten it wrong sometimes. But again and again and again, they've proven themselves right. And unfortunately, those relationships are really built with time. That's a challenge. I'll take the last one right here. Sorry. I will answer afterwards, but please. Well, I think the real challenge, and this is one of the reasons we really want to understand typologies of people, there are people who think there are facts and they're in the New York Times. And there are people who think there are no facts and they're definitely not in the New York Times. And there are people who think there are facts and they're all on Fox News. And so that's why that typology piece becomes important. Because what we're doing right now by saying fake news and facts are something you need to worry about, I need to understand you. Maybe it isn't something you need to worry about, depending on what you watch on television, what your goals are. So that's the thing we really want to do. We want to understand the starting point of people so we're not wasting people's times with lessons they don't need, right? And so that really, I think, is the key. And I think it shows the value of us getting people from different disciplines together And like a good news reporter, it's 11:45 and it's lunch. I just want to say I've enjoyed being with you all year. If there's anything I can do, please let me know. But thank you for coming out in the cold to do this last one. Thank you.